Hello and welcome to AFP. My name is Devang Desai and I'm joined by the usual suspects, David Goss and Nick Andrade. On today's show, we chat another strong week for the Canadian teams in MLS, the latest on the NWSL and the actions the league and the players have taken since the game's postponements this weekend. Plus, World Cup qualifiers are back in a really big week for Canada with some tough games and a bunch of questions in the mailbag Ask AFP. Gentlemen, how are we doing? Busy weekend. David, update us. What is new in your world?
You know, strong weekend. I don't know. Great time to be alive here in New York. I went to a college football game on Saturday.
Wow.
It is the first college football game I've been to in probably 12 years. And it was the Ohio State against the Rutgers University. I don't think they do the thing that hard. And the shuttle bus to the game broke down. So we walked in a few minutes late and it was already 17-0 or 14-0.
And Rutgers was good. They were supposed to be good this year, slightly better. I'm a Michigan guy, so I hope you didn't cheer for Ohio State at all.
Do you actually watch and care about college football?
I used to when I was younger, like the Brian Greasy, Charles Woodson years, but that's when I had family that went to Michigan. So that's why I was like kind of invested, but less so now, and especially less so when they get pummeled by Ohio State every year. So I'm kind of out.
Yeah, it is in a sporting sense, it is everything I despise about the world in one place. Like everyone there who's like a huge college football fan, I'm like, why don't you watch the NFL? It's like, well, they don't play for passion. You're like, oh, you don't like when people get paid for the things they do? Cool.
Passion.
So
what?
So it's always fun, but I did a lot of Jello shots, which was very good. And it was
Did you party with Urban Meyer after the game? I saw you.
I did not. Here's an unreal story though. A week previous, I was in Columbus for Campeones Cup, which is a true sporting competition, not like college football.
Correct.
And I went and watched Monday Night Football at an outdoor space bar, and it was the bar. I was sitting at the bar that Urban Meyer was getting danced on at. I think it's Amazing. Short North Pint House is what it's called.
Wow.
So, and you can say you've been there. You can say you've been there.
I'm really, hey, Herbs.
I'm really
Herbs,
happy
I get
you.
It, man. Life is hard.
I love his apology. He's like, oh, I should have left. It was like the main crux of it. That's just hilarious. Nick, how are you doing, sir? We'll talk about sports and soccer, but that soccer game on Sunday was truly an uplifting occasion. And then the local baseball team, through no fault of their own, although you can argue through prior losses it was their fault, did not make the playoffs. Very sad, but positive day, weirdly.
Yeah, I texted you guys. Watching Man City Liverpool, at the end of the game, I didn't feel like my normal angsty self where I just wanted to not do anything. It was a great game with two great teams. And by the end, I was kind of just like out of breath because it was just so exciting. But then later in the day, obviously, with our Toronto Blue Jays and our local Toronto teams, other than TFC won, which was great, but that didn't really pad any of the blows that the Toronto Blue Jays and the pain caused us, I don't think, Devang.
The scheduling gods were not kind to TFC. No. I do not know what the count was for people at that game, but on a Sunday at 4 p.m. with, forget the Jays and like the crazy MLB and NFL football everywhere, horrible day outside, looked like one of the end of the world movies happening. So
it did. It
they
did.
Won though, and we will talk about that shortly. Huge.
I will say,
huge.
There was a moment, I think it was after the Salah goal, when Ederson hit a ball that put Foden through. That was like an 80-yard ball on the dime. Where I was like, these people are playing a different sport. Like it's really crazy. Is. Now we've had this conversation a million times on the show. I don't know that Liverpool has the depth to keep it up. But they have returned, although Van Dijk got tripped up by Bernardo Silva, which I don't think I've ever seen that happen before.
Yeah.
But they have returned pretty close to what their championship team was, and City's still City. And it's, you watch Man U in the morning shuffle along with talent, and then you watch that in the next day or the afternoon, and it is two different games.
Can I say, too, that Man City, after the week that they had, they played Chelsea, PSG, and Liverpool. To get 4 points in the league is pretty impressive, especially when you know, they're at Anfield as well.
Monster week. That is an insane week, fixture wise. Pep also got spat on, or his crew got spat on at the end, so not a great end, but points were taken. All right, A reminder, folks, we are on patreon.com/footballpodcast. A big thank you to those that have joined us. We hit our goal of 30 last week, which is awesome. We're going to keep doing exclusive Patreon episodes, including our Euro Roundup this week. So join us to get that. Join us to get on the Discord where we're chatting footy all the time. And you also get this show ad-free. So head on over to patreon.com/footballpodcast and join us today when we come back. The latest on the fallout from the NWSL, that huge athletic story from Meg Linehan. We talk about that and also a very solid week for the MLS teams in Canada. Welcome back to AFP. DG, shortly after we recorded last week, or a couple, maybe a day after, The Athletic, who's had some monster stories in terms of North American soccer these last couple of years, had another one. Meg Linehan about the actions of Paul Riley with multiple players across multiple stops during his time, both in the NWSL and also in other professional leagues. The fallout has been massive. The latest, we've had Sally Yates, who, if you're an American political head, you'll remember her name. She was in the government, I think, right, as an AG, a very high acting law department person. She's now on investigating this. We've had board resignations from the U.S. Soccer Federation, including Lisa Baird, who resigned her position on the U.S. board and was thought to have been one of the key members of this, I guess, this group of people who have been controlling the league, David. But I guess, what is your reaction to this? What's been your take? Because I think we share a lot of alignment in terms of our beliefs outside of the game. And I feel like this obviously deals with soccer, but this is also about how this league has been structured and how these players have been taken advantage and no one has really done anything to stop it.
Yeah, I think even outside of that, it's depressing about society that there are people like this out there who use their positions of power to, you know, make other people's lives harder and abuse other people. And then the system as a whole that we've built both here in the NWSL and then just in general, that it protects those people and hides those people. And it's easier for those people to hide than it is for victims to be believed and to be assisted. So it was really sad to read. It was disgusting to read as well, but it's necessary. So I encourage everyone who hasn't to go and read it. And I encourage everyone who hasn't to sign up for a subscription to The Athletic, because it is important that Meg had the platform to build this, to put this story out there and to get the response that she's gotten. And she's an incredible sports writer and she's already done a ton for the game in my country. And I think in Canada and the region as well. Her coverage of the women's game and NWSL and the women's national team and everything else that's gone on. But this was something else. I mean, this was outside of sports writing. This was impressive. And I can't even imagine her just having to like live with this as you're studying it and, you know, interviewing people and writing it. And because it was hard for me to deal with just reading it, the once off that I've read it so far. But it's really sad. And I think Meg made a point recently, and I don't know how to quantify it yet, but maybe just saying this is what a sports league is, because this is how all the leagues that we've ever had are organized, because they've all been men's leagues, and just saying, well, we'll just put women athletes in there and we'll just do it again. Mm-hmm. Maybe that doesn't work. And I don't know what that means totally. Like, does that mean maybe coach player relationships aren't what we thought they are? The way the club is organized in terms of what the roles are that exist isn't the way it's meant to be. Maybe we're talking about medical issues where, you know, there are specific things that should be focused on that maybe aren't focused on. There's probably a lot that goes into that. But I think Meg put it best when she said the players are the league, and the future of for women's sports, I think is pushed by a lot of these players specifically. And whatever it is that we do, we need to both protect them and then give them the platform that they need. So the name NWSL, I don't think matters. And maybe mm-hmm. specifically even some of these clubs' names don't matter. It's about creating a space and a platform for all these players to perform at their highest level. And it feels like part of what happened last week or over the last few weeks was that with the induction of Angel City's ownership group, with all these, you know, influential women that maybe can lead this league separately, a lot of the players see an opportunity to maybe restructure the way the game is created in this region and then maybe around the world. And I hope that's the case. And I think all we can do is support the players as they go about that battle and that push. And I wish they didn't have to, but it feels like if it happens, it's going to be an Alex Morgan who leads that down the road.
Alex Morgan, who basically called out Lisa Baird for not responding when they asked the league to reopen the investigation against Paul Riley, which was detailed online, on Twitter, and then, of course, in Meg's piece as well. I echo everything you said, David. I think my beyond like the human cost and the horrible things that have happened to these players, I think the way this league has been structured is predatory, and the fact that these contracts are not guaranteed in the way they aren't, and the way that the clubs are basically in alignment with each other, it's once you sign up, it's not really about you anymore, unless you're a megastar. So if that's what it takes to make this league quote-unquote financially viable, which seems to be the siren call when it comes to why are these contracts like this? Why is it that players are basically traded on a whim based on personal coaches' decisions? Like, this is where to start as well, and it sounds like the reckoning is happening. And I maybe to close this chapter on this, David, like, do you think the European avenues for these players, it is only just be more enticing now? Is that going to be a thing that happens with some of these players, or do you think there's a less immediate reaction?
No, I think there'll probably be that, but I think there's only so many spots for American and Canadian players in those teams and in the ones that can really pay you. And so that's why this still matters, because there's still a ton of really good players who have to play here and want to play here. And so there's not enough places, I think, around the world with enough investment and setups for these quality of players to go and play at. And so whatever professional setup happens here in North America is still necessary to exist, and will probably, in some extent, I know the USL has announced that they were going to put together a fully professional second division league. I don't know if that's something that makes sense, although again, you're looking at an already male built previously existing hierarchy and then saying let's add the women's league to that, so maybe that doesn't help. But I echo what you said in terms of you created a power dynamic that existed this way, and so you can't be totally shocked when something like this is possible. But there's got to be a way to reshift that power dynamic, and part of it is investment. You know, if players have reasonable salaries, then you can feel like you're strong enough to push back. And so that's part of it. Part of it's on coverage, and that's on us as well, right? Not enough people were probably covering this to know what was going on and to leak these stories earlier on. And if you had people laser focused in on some of these teams, you would have gotten some of these stories out there earlier and maybe done less damage. So all of that matters. And I think all of that's part of changing it for the future.
And just to juxtapose that, this story coming out during the same week where the talk of the biannual World Cup really picking up steam, and Arsene Wenger talking, flapping his gums about how this is good for the game. And then you have people being like, well, this is another opportunity to just basically not broadcast women's soccer during that same time period when they have big tournaments scheduled that should capture massive audiences. This is just another men's tournament to throw in there. And there's really no thought to that idea of how to spread the game. But just, I found that interesting as well. Of like, okay, yeah. So we're in a double pronged situation where it's amazing that Meg has written this and that The Athletic has done this work, but I agree with you that it's change needed all over the place. The NWSL has announced a new executive committee, including Amanda Duffy, Angie Long, Sophie Savage from Olympic Lyon, plus the hiring of an outside firm. Like, Sally Yates is involved now. You got some huge heavy hitters. All eyeballs are on them. It's about time, but I'll be fascinated to see what comes out of this and if there is some restructuring to the actual league itself, because I know this is a real boogeyman term in North American soccer when you talk about restructuring the financials to make things viable, and you get a lot of bullshit, but this is bigger than that, obviously. Shall we talk about the Canadian MLS teams, David?
Yeah, let's do it.
Your Vancouver Whitecaps are in a playoff spot for the time being. Sorry, they're not. They're 1 point out, but they got games in hand. They have a game in hand on Real Salt Lake and the LA Galaxy, and they trail them by 2 points. A big win over San Jose, the draw against Houston. Oh, real tough watch generally. It's one of those games as well. It's a fall game, midweek. What do you expect? I shouldn't have expected much, David. I think that's what I learned walking away from that. But they went on and they kept doing Vancouver stuff. I mean, they're still missing some guys, but your hypothesis on Lucas Cavallini kind of having to be that guy has continued to ring true, but it doesn't seem like he is going to be, though. But
I think it was challenged by Brian White scoring a hat trick.
Well, what I'm saying is the idea is the guy being there was right, and it was right that they're going to need someone up front to lead the line and bag a bunch of goals, and we just assumed it would have to be Lucas Cavallini. But Brian White's done this now for enough games where it's... I think we're okay with this. This is how they will play. They'll have Ryan Gauld moving in between the lines, and they'll have a really opportunistic guy having an absolute heater score goals. Here we are. They're just outside the playoffs.
So I think the first thing I walked away from the San Jose game with was they played like a playoff game. They blew San Jose off the field, not from a goal scoring point of view, but just from an energy and focus point of view over those first 25, 30 minutes. I mean, San Jose was not in this game at all until later on when Vancouver was already well ahead and fairly comfortable. So from a mentality point of view, they had some tough road trip games and they got points maybe that are the results are fine, but the performance wasn't at the level that you'd hope. And they came home and fixed a lot of that. And so this team's really dangerous. One of the big ones is playing Dahomey at left wing back. He has full freedom to attack from there. It's gotten another attacker on the field. So even though it's a quote unquote more defensive setup, it hasn't been the case. And then this week it was Nerwinski at left center back, who's a natural fullback who pushed forward into the attack as well. And so you've just got a lot of pieces out there and there's a lot of movement. It's a lot for Ryan Gauld to play with. You see him all over on the field, linking up, connecting, beating guys, finding slip balls here and there. And you saw this team at their best. This was impressive. This was a huge performance. This was a big moment for them. Their schedule coming up, I think, is both the Cascadia teams away and another playoff team in the middle, a KC at home in the middle. So it's at Seattle, home to KC, at Portland. That is a meat grinder of the next stretch. And that's where I talk about Cavallini. It's like, you're getting stuff from Brian White. It's great, but you need plus to this. This is not enough, I don't think. You need to add to it. And if it's someone else, that's fine. But I don't think that other person exists on the roster. And if Cavallini's healthy enough to play for Canada, and if he gives you performances for Canada over the next 10 days in World Cup qualifying, then he needs to find a way to bring that back and do something for this team down this stretch. I still think they're a playoff team under Sartini. And I think that was only emboldened for me this week.
Fanny in. The playoff team, my mistake, Montreal is now in a playoff spot in the East after a pretty remarkable win against Atlanta United. Basically, Atlanta United, if Joseph Martinez is not involved, it is a real problem. And full credit to Montreal for seizing on that. Martinez left at about halftime, I believe.
Yeah, he went off at halftime. Right. The two subs at halftime created the goal. It was Mulroney and Araujo who came on, and they literally linked up like 3 minutes later.
But then Ramel Kyoto bags a brace, and Wilfs Nancy's job continues to make its own case for coach of the year. I think he's got to be one of the favorites. They got trucked a bit midweek by New England. It was maybe a measuring stick kind of game. I think there should be no illusions of what Montreal really is. And I know the playoffs are a wholly different animal, and we can see what Nashville did to TFC last year if Montreal can shut it down. But all that aside, I thought the rebound from getting handled by New England was impressive. And also beating Atlanta, who I thought would be, when it's all said and done, probably their main competition for that last spot. What a huge result.
Yep. And it's, I've said it all. I think I've said it all season, but it's them rebounding, right? It's a bad loss to Columbus last week. And then I think the Revs game is a bit of a throwaway. And then to come back, and not only you come back, but you go down 1-0 at home out of halftime. And you come back and score minutes later, and you double it after that. And I don't think Atlanta controlled a lot of this game, because Atlanta is a pretty high possession team, whether, you know, wherever they're playing in MLS. And so Montreal kind of sat in, and I thought stuck around in the first half. And then in the second half, they get the goal from an absurd angle from Kyoto, and kind of a moment of brilliance. But then they grew from there, and they grew on that. And The mentality of this team's unbelievable, and it's an unproven group. And that's where Wilfred Nancé, I think, will be a finalist top three for coach of the year, because he's the one who's creating this culture.
It's defo Ted Lasso vibes with the feel good story in Montreal.
He dresses a little better.
He does. He does. I know. And he's also more versatile, I think. Yeah. Dress wise. MLS roundup, Orlando. Boy, oh boy. Desperately needed the result against DC United. Daryl DK, maybe the biggest goal of the season for that club. I think if we want to lay out what we think the playoff picture will look like at the end of the season, David, that Orlando win is massive, because DC United don't look now, but if they manage to pull that off, you're looking at maybe a three seed.
Yeah.
But here we are, and there's still a huge glut. I think Philadelphia is in third at 42 points, tied with Orlando, but Atlanta sitting on the outside looking in is only 3 points behind them.
And just to point out, so the Red Bulls are in ninth right now, six points out of the playoffs.
I think I buried them expressly.
So did I. But their game in hand is against Montreal this Sunday because of the World Cup qualifying, which isn't bad for Red Bull because they don't lose a ton of players for World Cup qualifying. Maybe Casares. I don't really know who else. And so if they win that game, they're only 3 points out of the playoffs and 2 points behind Atlanta, which begs the question, Devang Desai. Put your name on it. Signature. Who are the playoff teams in the East and the West?
All of them. Okay. Well,
No. You could do, I don't know. Give me the 5, 6, 7.
I got you. Okay. So in the Eastern Conference, I think it's going to stay as it is, actually. I don't have a shocking pick here. I think the order will change, but I have Orlando, DC, New York City FC will finish seventh, I think. I really don't like it. I think Tinnerholm also getting hurt could be shockingly bad for them. But I have Montreal finishing sixth is my pick, David. But I have the current teams in, staying in, because I think Martinez, whatever happens to him, I just don't know. I don't know what else is there for Atlanta right now. And I understand he's an amazing player, but the reliance is huge. Red Bulls, huge fight back, but too little too late. And I think we fully can bury the Columbus Crew after this weekend.
I think Andre Blake did that for us.
Yeah, he did.
Just absurd save against Nagby after saving the penalty kick. Okay, so that's your three. Well, actually, I don't have to give mine because you're doing it. So you want to go west now?
I'll go west. Put it on my toque and holding my hockey stick as I say this, but I think the Vancouver Whitecaps will not only make the playoffs, but they'll finish fifth. Ooh. I'm looking at the teams in front of them. Galaxy,
they're in a nosedive.
What the hell was? I mean, there's El Tráfico, also a bit buzzless in my opinion this weekend. 1-1. Real Salt Lake had that bump from Mastroianni at the beginning, but I think this is the reality now of what that squad is in terms of who's playing well. Mm-hmm. I like Vancouver here. So I think outside, and honestly, I don't think Colorado is that untouchable either, but I think points wise they will be uncatchable. But as the outside of the top four in the West, I like the Caps at five, and then give me the Loons, who again, not super convincing, and Adrian Heath is wilding constantly at all times. I don't know what's going on. So I think they'll get in based on just sheer talent. And then I hope Greg Vanney gets in at seven, but I don't know what's going on with the Galaxy. Victor Vasquez gave me life because he's still amazing. And I think back to the discourse of when he was coming back to the league. And I think I was pretty strong in saying, I don't know if it's worth it for us or TFC, and he's washed, etc. He's not the problem there. He is fantastic.
So I respect the ground that Victor Vasquez walks on. I think he's a soccer genius. I do think in that El Tráfico game, his level of influence is a sign of the weaknesses of both teams on the field. Like the fact that LAFC didn't have anyone within 15 yards of a guy who doesn't really move that much was pretty damning itself. And then the fact that Galaxy are playing through a guy who doesn't really move that much is pretty damning as well. But I agree with your picks. Obviously, as we mentioned, the Vancouver schedule is tough, but they are the only team here that is, one, trending in that direction and seems to be able to at least keep things level, where these other teams get blown out and then they beat a good team and then they get blown out. And Vancouver, while there's been maybe less ideal results or not picking up full 3 points, it's all been fairly consistent game in and game out.
It's been a while since the Whitecaps have had huge games like this coming up, and especially Cascadia ones. That's awesome. So super exciting.
I mean, I follow all of the supporters groups out in Vancouver, and you know, they're putting up the IG stories and everything going into the game, and then you watch it on TV, and obviously it's not full capacity and whatever, but it feels exciting. It feels fun. And I've never been to the stadium, and I know it's not the newest stadium in the league, but it holds noise. And when that place is bumping, it's bumping.
It does. I lived there when Fonzie was still there, and that place it's really fun. And not Women's World Cup. You saw that. It can be a really fun place. So here's hoping, crossing our fingers for the Caps and CF Montreal. All right. When we come back, speaking of crossing your fingers and praying to various deities, World Cup qualifying is back. A really monstrous week for Canada, the USA as well. We'll talk about all that coming up next on AFP. Welcome back to a football podcast. Well, well, well. Another huge three games in the octagonal round. Octagonal round of the CONCACAF.
I think it just depends on your accent. I don't think there's a right and wrong there before.
I had a huge personal crisis in that split second about how I say things. But it's big time, big time, big time. Canada, daunting task. Travel to Mexico, travel to Jamaica, and then back home on Panama, against Panama, and then the United States, Jamaica on Thursday, Panama on Sunday, Costa Rica on Wednesday. Let's start with Canada, folks. I'll be honest here. I do feel quite nervous about this slate of games. I think the beginning, the first round, went as good as can go. I think you probably want a result against Honduras, but they responded well. Great result to the United States, and they took care of business against El Salvador. But, capital B, I think we all knew that the real litmus test would come in this second group of games. And anytime you have to go to Mexico to play, it's a big thing. But we have COVID now. We have some guys that won't be able to play against Jamaica and because of red list notifications and then the home game against Panama. Thing? I believe Junior Hoilett and David Weatherspoon will not be able to play.
Okay, will not be those able are to the go only two. To
Jamaica. I believe so, yeah.
So on the U.S. side, originally none of the English players or English-based players were going to go to Panama. Now people are saying that's if you're fully vaccinated, that's no longer true. But I don't know the different lists in the different maybe they're on different lists.
What I read as you record this on Monday is that it'll be Junior Hoilett and Weatherspoon who can't play in that game specifically. Okay. Yeah. But yeah, that's kind of my kind of mood, but I wonder how you guys are viewing this. I mean, the names on paper speak for themselves, but Jamaica hasn't exactly been great. My worry is that if they're primed for something, it would be now, kind of. But again, it's not much like tape to go off of.
No, we don't know if they're a cohesive team yet. And the Panama loss, they dominated the game. It's just a bad mistake and an unbelievable strike to give Panama a lead. And then Jamaica, in chasing, created chances, but sort of left themselves exposed. But to me, this window comes down to Herdman. Even more than last window. Like, I don't have an answer for how you handle this. How much do you put into the Mexico away game? And then from that, I think there are players in this pool, Atiba being the largest, who have limits on the amount of minutes you can use them. And are you using them in the right spot at the right time? And you look at the last window and you look at the team they put out there against the US that got the result. I don't think Kyle Larin's healthy. I think he's put on this roster because you're hoping he gets healthy during it, but he can't start one of the first two games. And Scott Kennedy's not on this team. So, like, where are you getting those minutes now is the question mark. And I don't have an answer to it.
It's a huge... This Kennedy miss is, I think, going to be very interesting because I think they can find ways around it. Like, you could, there's a group of players among Vitoria, Danielle Henry, Alistair Johnston... Let's throw Derek Cornelius in the mix, ZBG as well.
But would you? Will you play Derek Cornelius in a way World Cup qualifier right now? And I'm a fan.
Not in Mexico.
I'll be honest. 2 years ago, I would have said yes. I thought he was trending in that direction when him and Danielle Henry were center backs, you know, a pairing at Vancouver. And then after Henry left, I thought Cornelius was going in that direction. I can't say that anymore. Now, in fairness, I don't watch the Greek second division, but like that's kind of where we're at with him. And I think that's the problem. Now, you could put out Akube in that group, right? And you start him at left center back. Or is it fair? Miles Robinson played 270 minutes for the U.S. in the last window. Is it possible to get that out of Kamal Miller? And if it is, then that's your answer.
I think Kamal Miller is the answer, the internal answer. I think the Herdman question is massive. Because if you're a betting person or if you're playing the odds, like what is your expected probability of getting out of Mexico with a point as opposed to Jamaica? Does that change who you use? Mexico being the first game, though, I think might be a benefit, perhaps. I don't know how.
Oh, interesting.
I think if you go into that game, maybe assuming you will take 0 points and maybe you play that way, you're saving yourself for the other games.
So I think that's interesting. I see it the opposite, which is you would love to go into the Mexico game knowing you have 4 points already in the window and saying we have nothing to lose. Because my issue here is I don't want to set the wrong tone for the group, right? And you could say whatever you want. If he puts out a B team, they know it's a B team. And if you get smashed, if you lay down and die there, I think it's hard to rally your group again. But on the flip side, if you steal something, it's great. The one thing I go back to is the group in the Gold Cup final or Gold Cup semifinal. That wasn't the A team, and they did enough. They should have, you know, gone to extra time or whatever. And that was without Davies. So I think there's a chance. My guess would be you start Jonathan David because you don't have Laren. And you're saying, okay, we kind of took it easy with him last time. This is it. Like, this is the time where we need him. And he probably starts all three games. And I think you don't start Atiba because you can get the performances without him at center mid. And I think you start Davies, which allows you, if you want to start out of Kube at left center back.
Can I just say, isn't there like an extra fire in their belly almost for what happened in the Gold Cup? And especially with, I think we've seen the Mexico team, especially in that first part of the qualifying, isn't the Mexico of old, right? It looks a little, I don't know, like it can be beaten. I feel like this is something like, again, especially like you said, it's a B team that played in the Gold Cup semifinal. There's a huge chance that they could get a draw out of this. No,
I think it's paramount that they play with that same mindset that they showed in Houston in that semifinal, which is like not fear. Or like not that we're gonna get pummeled by these ballers, and they weren't. Because I think you're right. I think the squad that they called up this time around, they got the guns. Like Jimenez is back.
Yeah, that's Herbie the big one.
Chucky Lozano's there. Like it's gonna be. I'm fast forwarding to imagining those guys running against some of our defenders, and like just thinking about that, like it's gonna be really hard. Like I feel like you almost gotta just duck this game and look at Jamaica. But I understand what you're saying, David, and I think the mentality of the group is so important. You only have them for so long. It's like you're like a week summer camp. You go away, you come back, but like maintaining that mood from one solid week is gonna be so important. So
to be clear, I'm not advocating either way because I really don't know. I don't know the right answer to this. And to your point, Mexico's biggest issue that Nick was talking about has been goal scoring. And now they have Jimenez and Chucky Lozano back. And Sebastian Cordova, I don't think was in the camp last time. I think he is a problem for anyone else in the region. He's like Thomas Mueller-esque. He just pops up and scores goals. So that shouldn't be an issue. This will also, reminder, because of the issues that we have with Mexico fans chanting, potentially homophobic things, depending on who you're talking to. This is their first home game with a crowd since like 2018 World Cup qualifying because Mexico never plays in Mexico.
That ban got reduced, correct?
Yeah, it was supposed to be two for games. This game.
Yeah.
And then they reduced it to one game because, for sure,
funny
the forward-thinking nature.
Putting on my optimist cap, though. The TFC boys, they played Mexico a bunch. They should be used to this.
An Oso will be comfortable in this setting.
And Richie, I think, is perfect for games like this as long as his head's on straight and he's in it.
Here's the question with Richie. I think Richie starts no matter what. But I think if Herdman decides that he doesn't maybe want to start Davies, it's Tejan on the right and it's Richie on the left. Yeah. Otherwise, it's Richie on the right and Fonzie on the left, probably, unless he thinks it's safer defensively to go three natural center backs, probably starts Kamal and then slides out of Kube out to the left. Whatever it is, I think those are his two levers he can push is one game, the attack's probably going to run through Tejan and Eustaquio, and one game it's going to run through Davies and Eustaquio. And then I think that final home game, it's a must-win game. There is no question about it. The Jamaica away game might be, just because if Jamaica struggles this badly, other teams start to beat up on them. But I've said from the beginning, and I'm not going away from, I think this region is closer together than anyone realizes, and there will be results consistently where you think a team has gotten the big away points and now they're going to cruise at home and they drop those points. For example, Honduras got 2 away points to start last window and then they lost to the US. So I think all of that still exists, and it's not as straightforward right now as these are lost points and they have to make them up. But I think 4 to 5 points is the necessity for this window.
Major shout out to Jacob Schaffelberg getting the call up. One of the reasons to watch TFC these days.
Nova Scotia's own?
East Coast, Best Coast, but...
Or New Brunswick? Which state?
I think it's Nova Scotia.
Province. Sorry, Nick.
And confusing those two is a huge problem that will probably result in some email. But really. I believe it is Nova Scotia. Wait, if I got that wrong now. Amazing story, but just like in the actual footballing terms, I think Schaff could be a big use in especially against Mexico, depending on how this game goes. But someone who can run for days, threaten a back line, make some runs, has a motor that you're going to need because of these games. I like the addition, and I think he'll play a bit. I don't think this is just come for the tour.
Yeah, the back end of this roster, I think, is weaker than it was last roster. Sorry, that was not a knock at Jacob Schaffelberg. But Brim making the roster, Cornelius getting on, like, it doesn't feel as deep and strong, but I think the players who will be a part of the group are equally as strong. By the way, he's from Nova Scotia.
Thank God. Shouts to that wonderful province. Province. Just to confirm, province. But where they do have states is the United States, David. And that's what we call a segue. They're back. No Reyna, no Pulisic, but Weston McKennie. his excommunication, his banishment from the kingdom is over. And the guy, Yassi Zardes, is back, which you know he'll play well. What's the mood like for Greg Berhalter's group, DG?
I think it's a weird one. You're missing Pulisic and Reyna, who are two of the attacking leaders of this group. And then since the roster's come out, Tim Ream's withdrawn from the roster, and now it sounds like John Anthony Brooks is about to withdraw as well. And so we felt coming into qualifying that we had depth, and now so far it's been tested at every single stage. And so I think it's still a little bit nervy. And then there's also more expectations in my mind. 2 home games. Jamaica so far has shown that they're one of the weaker sides in this group. This Costa Rica group is fairly weak as well, but they're never going to lay down. And so you're talking about 2 must-win games that are not easy to win, with an away trip in the middle against a Panama side that probably had the best window of any team last World Cup qualifying. So I don't think it's simple. I don't think it's straightforward in any way. And I think, similar to what I'm talking about with Herdman, you got to look at the pie of the minutes available from each player, and you got to start to figure out, how do you dice it up? And in my mind, Jamaica at home is a game where we dominate possession. And so I think you give some players opportunity there that you wouldn't play in Panama. So I think of Busio, Yunus Musa maybe making his debut, Chris Richards potentially making his debut, or Mark McKenzie. Both of them are better on the ball than other players in this pool, where like a Walker Zimmerman was made for an away game at Panama, where you're sitting behind the ball and defending as a group. Sergiño Dest is another player where maybe there's a specific breakdown home and away with the way you play him as well in this window. So the Honduras game ended on a high in the last window, and I think we're kind of back into a question mark. Like, it's you're not going to be able to put the same group out there. And so there's question marks now of who can perform and who can step up.
I mean, just looking at the schedule, I think outside of Mexico, I think the USA has most points pressure, as in they should pick up these points against their opponents. I think if you look at who Mexico's playing, and Canada's included, this should be a very profitable group of games for them. And if it's not, and if it starts poorly against Canada, I wonder what that does to a group that has been shaky as well with their coach and his relationship with the media after not beating the States a bunch of times. So one game can change everything. The thing, and I keep circling back to this, but perhaps I have a defeatist mentality for the Mexico game, but I think if they can somehow conjure that Gold Cup magic or have that mentality that they carry there with the addition of Fonzie, who wasn't there, can that produce the unexpected? Because then we're looking at maybe an unconventionally good window for Canada. But we're at the point now where we'll lay out what we think is going to happen. Like, what do you see? Do you see this table looking way different in a couple of days or with the next time we record? Or do you see maybe things following the script where you have USA, Mexico taking care of business and maybe Canada needing a result against Jamaica?
It's tough. It wouldn't shock me if Canada did get a point at Mexico. I think the way it's going to work out is it's going to be like a devastating 2-1 loss, like the Gold Cup semifinal. And that's not like a knock. That's part of that is that's the nature of the beast, which is you're at altitude. You've got to deal with those conditions. You're dealing with a team that's going to be banging on the door. It's not a coincidence that a team like that scores late goals, right? It's just that's when the breakdown finally comes. And so I wouldn't be shocked by that. And then at the same time, I wouldn't be shocked if Canada can hold on. The one thing I love about Canada is they're built for this. Like we saw against the US, they are devastating in transition. They've got multiple outlets to play through in transition. You've got a guy in Eustáquio who can launch those players into the attack. And so what we saw in the Gold Cup was Tejan was able to terrorize this Mexico backline. And what we saw against the US was Alfonso Davies was able to terrorize that backline. So you've got all these options. You've got all this ability. I think I'd feel a little better if Kyle Larin was fit. I think he's key to when they play that way. And not that Jonathan David can't do that. It's just one, you would have had two guys that you potentially could use. And two, Larin just looks very comfortable in this setup where he kind of has to cover a ton of ground to be that second option to link up with those guys. I think you're looking... I believe the U.S. will get 3 points at home against Jamaica. I think it'll be uncomfortable. I think there'll be expectations that they win by 2 or 3 goals. I don't think that'll happen. But you are looking at a Jamaica team without Leon Bailey that you should be able to beat in this setting and that hasn't really played together. My assumption is Mexico beats Canada as well coming out of this window. And then I think El Salvador at home can hold Panama to at least a tie. If not better. So I guess that would net us out pretty close to where we're at, right? Where you'd have, it would be Mexico, yeah. US, Panama, Canada, 1 through 4 sort of in that order. Oh, and I didn't add Honduras, Costa Rica, which I would assume Honduras wins that game. So that would net you out coming out of this first game, pretty similar to where you're at now, but with then a must win against Jamaica. And then how big is the Canada-Panama game to close this whole thing out?
Oh boy, and I'll be there soaking it in nervously. Just before we go, Canada Soccer announced that Edmonton will host the November fixtures, which is pretty awesome. And in terms of using your advantage against certain teams for the region, we've seen Canada suffer in the heat, but now Costa Rica is traveling to Edmonton and so is Mexico. Good call by the CSA, I think. And going back to Fonzie's roots, Canadian roots, will be really cool.
Do I remember right that Canada played Mexico, I think it was 2010, World Cup qualifying. I'm trying to get it up as I'm saying it. And they played outside in the cold, I think. It was when Sven Goran Eriksson was manager and he like almost got fired. And I think Canada got a draw. Let's see if I can find it. Canada versus Jamaica, Canada versus... Mexico,
I'm pulling out Mexico. All the stops.
All right, here it is. 2-2. Legend. 2-2 on October 15th, 2008, in the Commonwealth Stadium in Edmonton.
Wow. Same place. We're going back
to Ali Gerba. We'll do it again. And Radzinski with the goals. Wow. Super Tom. What a squad.
Super Tom and Ali Gerba, whose names you might hear in a question.
This is almost like when Miami in the NFL goes to a cold climate in New England or something like that. Like this might be our kind of thing where they can't handle the cold.
And there's no VAR, so the tuck rule won't screw Canada,
I guess, as well. So, yeah. Yikes, dude! This was a squad. Obviously, Patrice Bernier got the start. Marcel De Jong with the start as well.
We got to get Sean K to phone in when we talk about this squad specifically.
Because legit.
He would talk for days.
How long do you think we get Sean to talk about Ian Hume?
God, I mean, we could release a 10-part podcast probably series with one-on-ones, Sean K and Hume. All right. That is your preview for a huge weekend or week of World Cup qualifiers. I hope you're as excited as we are, and we'll talk about what happens next week, of course. To wrap up this week's show, though, it's the mailbag coming up next.
Welcome back, and it's time for everyone's favorite segment, Ask AFP. Thanks to everyone who sent their questions this week. If you didn't get the chance to send your own question, just hop on Twitter and use the hashtag AskAFP and send them our way. Our first question goes to Matt from Discord, and he asks, is there friction between Bob Bradley and LAFC management? I'm wondering if he was in agreement with trading Marc-Anthony Kay and Zimmerman, or maybe he initiated both and management were not really on board with those trades.
I think it's a good question, Matt. I don't know if the two reasons you put down are why, but I think it's fair that the fact that Bob Bradley still doesn't have a contract shows you there is. Whether it's friction, maybe it's a change in direction, whatever it is, a guy like Bob Bradley doesn't normally run down his contract in a situation like this. If LAFC wants to bring him back, this is a weird way to do it. So there is something going on there, and it's why his name is getting mentioned everywhere else, because that's how the league, that's how the soccer sphere is viewing this. And it could be those things. I mean, none of us have really worked with Bob Bradley, but you could imagine it maybe isn't the easiest in the world. He's fairly specific about the way he sees things being done. I think he's brilliant. I think he's the best manager in the league, quite honestly. So some of it's warranted, but there has to be, and maybe not those moves as much as the Horta move and the Brian Rodriguez move and the idea of like succession planning without maybe putting together the proper roster to make it to or to finish off and win MLS Cup. That might be more where you see some of the disagreements or the different ideas between the ownership or the front office and Bob.
Just so happens that the Chicago Fire rebranded for the 9,000th time on Monday. But for a club looking to start over really and go back to some good times, doesn't Bob Bradley make a lot of sense? I know we talked about TFC, DG, but man, Chicago would look exciting with Bob Bradley in the fold because
it makes every bit of sense.
He's one of the few people that could maybe lift that group from the embers of not a failed franchise, but a team that's kind of invisible in terms of the city's imprint. So I kind of think it's time. I think the LAFC project has been amazing. And those first couple of years, it was electric, frankly. But I don't know if this is recency bias after watching a lot of El Tráfico and being like, well, I know the DPs haven't been around much and they haven't got a lot out of the guy like Vela, etc. But maybe it's time.
It's a bad team right now. And part of that's injuries and part of that's not. But objectively, LAFC is a bad team. What's interesting about him in Chicago, real quick, sorry, Nick, is just he has that connection to the past, but he is a very progressive and modern coach. Mm-hmm. So it's not a tired pick to bring him in because he'll play the soccer I think people want. And I was in Columbus last week and I was talking to, I think it was a Liverpool fan, at the bar that Urban Meyer got grinded on once again. And something he said, which I thought was interesting, he said, I'm a crew season ticket holder now because it feels like a European game to me. Like the way they play, the way the stadium now is, the way the feeling around the club is, that's how he connects it to. And I think Bob Bradley is capable of bringing that to the Chicago Fire, but also getting results.
Devang saying, bringing the team back from the embers. Bravo. That nice. Was a great...
was that correctly used? Did I mess that up, that analogy?
Is it? I think you were stoking the embers to reignite the flame.
It was one of those things where I had it in my head and I'm like, this will sound amazing. But as I was saying it, I'm like, I have confused.
It worked for me.
In Devang's head, he just swagged into the room and was like, I'm nothing drunk on these guys.
C asks, will Lucas Cavallini be sold after this season based on his performances? It seems that Brian White is doing the job as we speak, Devang.
I'll say this is Brian White's biggest fan in terms of what he's been able to do for the Whitecaps, but I think this is a massive couple weeks for Lucas Cavallini. Like, I think a lot of what happens in the future with him will depend on these next couple of months, whether it be with the national team or the Whitecaps, David. I think that it's that important. Whether or not they sell him or not, I mean, what's the market like? Like, what has he done really since he's been there? It'll be at a loss for sure, I think. So the goal, the hope has to be that he finds it or gets healthy enough to find the ability to play enough to find it. And he's as important as Brian White has been, because that's what they need. Selling him, I think, it's an admitting failure. I don't know if it's an exact failure just yet.
Where we stand right now, if you get an offer for him, then you sell him.
Sure.
Because what you've proven is that you could bring in any other DP forward or probably a TAM level forward and be good enough, because you're getting what you get from Brian White and you are getting zero from Cavallini right now. So if you brought in a TAM level striker who was, you know, solid alongside White, you would be better than you are and you would be saving the money. And not just the money, there's probably something where if you're getting zero from Cavallini the rest of this year, you end up with a locker room situation that you have to deal with of the highest priced player on this team is giving us the least. How do other players feel about that? And how does whatever manager deal with that? So I think if you get a legitimate offer, and that's probably from Liga MX because of his background there and the success he had and the amount of money down there. I think there was rumors about La Liga, right, Devang? Mm-hmm. Like a few months back or at the beginning of the year. I don't know if any of those were real or if there's maybe a specific coach that he had played for that was looking at him, whatever it was. I think if you get any of that, and so we're talking like in the $4 million range, and then you get rid of him and you just move on because you've proven you could win without him. And then you can use the resources to reinvest, even if it's not at the same level. And I think continue to be as competitive, if not more competitive. But as you said, if he crushes it with Canada in the next 10 days, comes back, scores a bunch of big goals and leads this team to the playoffs, and he shows he can be a part of this, then the same reason you signed him in the first place, one, his quality, to the need for a legitimate goal scorer in this league to win. And then three, his standing with the Canadian national team as a face of your club. All of those still exist.
Jay asks, how does League's Cup benefit or hurt Canadian teams, David?
I think it benefits Canadian teams because you only get to play big League MX sides if you're the one CCL team. So it sounds like the new structure for the CCL, if a Canadian team wins MLS Cup, they would also get that bid. So the possibility already exists without League's Cup of two Canadian MLS teams getting into CCL if they're able to perform at that level. But the opportunity to play against bigger teams and bigger moments, I think that's going to be huge. And then when you look at the purpose for League's Cup, it's to sort of attempt to galvanize the massive support Liga MX has outside of Mexico and try and bring some of that attention and focus to your clubs. And that's the same for all these teams. And maybe Tigres isn't the biggest team in Toronto, as we saw in the Campeones Cup, but Chivas had a ton of fans at BMO when they played in the CCL final. And I think Club America did as well when they played in the CCL semis. So that's just Toronto specifically. And I think we've seen the same in Vancouver when they've played deep in the CCL as well. So that all still exists. So I think it's only positives for the Canadian teams. I can't think of how it would hurt them.
Well, I mean, perhaps the cynical view, like less so about the competition. Like, it's another cup that will probably take 20 to 40 minutes to explain what it is, or like how it works, or like who makes it. Fixture congestion, how does this matter, explaining that. I think it is cool to have Club America play TFC at BMO and have a bunch of Club America fans from the city come out. I think that is cool. So I'm definitely not against that, but I'm perhaps more indifferent than the rest. Like, I watched the Campeones Cup in Columbus on TV and it looked really cool. And when they got that first goal, like, it popped and you could understand why it's still important. But it feels almost like we're in a bit of a holding pattern in this like measuring stick idea with Liga MX and like the continued CCL stuff. I don't know if this is just another solution to get a win for the MLS clubs.
Okay. Nick, can I have open forum minute for to talk about Leagues Cup? Because I don't know. Have we even discussed it on this show? I can't even remember.
I don't think so.
Okay. Whoa. We need a new episode then. But I think everything you said is fair, Devang. So one thing is with Campione's Cup and the Leagues Cup currently, the fact that you are taking it out from being midweek in the season, to me, changes the conversation of explaining it or trying to judge its value a lot. Because part of what happened Wednesday night was, well, does Cruz Azul really care? Does Columbus really care? Can they focus on this game, other games, whatever? And then it did have the energy that you mentioned, but that doesn't happen anymore. And I think the other thing that will be really interesting is the way it's set up with this one game knockout NCAA tournament in the summer is, let's say Vancouver gets out of a tough group and now they win a round of 16 game. Now it's, I think, every 3 to 4 days, you're talking about something that's being talked about everywhere. And so by the time you get to a quarterfinal, especially a semifinal and a final, I think you're looking at momentum. And we've all been in cities where a team starts to make a playoff run and everyone gets on board. I think there'll be that type of feel to this. And so I think that will change it a little bit from trying to explain the 17 competitions that all these clubs play in now every Tuesday night and Thursday night and all that. So I think that's a little different. And then the one thing, because I guess we haven't talked about it, is, you know, everyone has said to me, well, what's this going to look like? Like, how are these MLS teams going to compete? And we have, every time we see an MLS club against the League MX club, it is a top five club in League MX. And I'm not saying that there isn't a high level of quality across the league, but there was no mechanism for non-top teams. Now, for example, Leagues Cup over the last two years, MLS put teams in that were not the top teams because they were already playing in CCL. Mexico doubled up, Liga MX doubled up on the same clubs, and Tigres, America, Cruz Azul, they all played in all of them. So I don't know that it's an assumed that a mid-table or lower table MLS team against a mid-table or lower League MX team means they get beat 9-0. And I think people feel that way. And I'm not saying they won't. I'm just saying we don't know yet.
I think that's fair. And I'm sure in a couple of days I'll have a Leagues Cup tattoo on my forearm after that speech. And I could tell David might have been sitting in on the Conference League group of UEFA planning, because I feel like that pitch is exactly why the Conference League exists.
Listen, have you seen Tottenham win on a Thursday night in Lithuania? Neither have I.
No, because they're drawing these teams. It's incredible. All right.
Well, this one hurts my heart. Ryan Burns asked, Maury to Canada, is it over? Because it damn well looks like.
Yeah, so he got called up to England's.
Yes.
But the way that the new language is now that he had, because he already has Canadian citizenship, is if he were to appear three times for them, then it would be 3 years in which he can't appear. He can't make the switch in those 3 years.
Could he not make the switch in the one-time switch category, or he's not able to do that?
That would be if he played a fourth game, I think. So I think three games means you can make the switch. Four games means you'd have to wait 3 years to make the switch or something like that. No, I think he'd still have to wait 3 years no matter what. So whatever it is, it feels fairly unlikely.
It feels over, yeah. It feels over.
Yeah, but I will just say I still think for a guy like that making this decision, where Canada sits right now, and especially where it might sit in a week, where it's like they might be on the path to World Cup qualification versus where they were when he made that decision, even though it felt like things were trending in the right direction, we didn't know. Mm-hmm. I think that opens the door to, if the England call-ups don't come while he's playing well and he feels frustrated, like he doesn't know what he can do, I think then the door opens to, I mean, at a minimum, you're qualifying for the 2026 World Cup no matter what. Because you're hosting.
Yeah.
And I don't, I think based off our conversation just now, there's probably no way to get him in for 2022, but I'm going to say 2% chance.
Two. That's better than mine. I'm saying zero. I think the dream is over. And I'm just looking at the squad. There's definitely a spot for someone of his abilities at the back. I wonder if, I mean, obviously just being in Chelsea and like, proximity to a bunch of English national team guys that must have had an influence on what his decision was. And if he could do it over again, he's at Milan now, he's outside of the England bubble. And I think in his favor is that Gareth Southgate seems to be a progressive man that is not England only, or you've got to play in the Prem to make my team. That's not his thing. So he's going to pick the best players. And frankly, I think Tomori is the best center back England has right now in terms of form, in terms of how well he's played this season so far. So the dream is over, but it's always nice to have some faint hope, I guess. 2% is good with me.
And finally, Jonas asks, what did you think of Landon Donovan's statue that was unveiled? Does it do him justice, or is it just another weird-looking statue?
Definitely not the worst one I've seen. I'll say that. I'm a statue hater. I don't really get it. I think he have an awful, awful statue outside of the Rogers Centre in Toronto. It's outside of a baseball stadium, and it's the head of the company who is deceased. It's really weird. It's like, I had a baseball player there. We won a couple World Series. What are you doing? So this is not that, and I can respect it. And they also went for a bit of a, I think the Beckham statue is like he's moving, but he's kicking a ball, so it looks kind of weird. This one, it's a better Selly kind of statue. So I think they did well here, considering the trash we've seen.
Okay. You are nicer than I am, so I'm going to leave it with Devang, because this thing creeps me out.
There's no good statues, guys. There's no good statues, is what I'm saying.
It looks right? like he's readying for battle, like in Braveheart right. or something. He's like,
Yeah. He doesn't even look human, I don't
think. He's getting ready to pitch some Herbalife on an all-day conference.
The way they did like each wrinkle in the face and the teeth, I think statues have to have closed mouths. I don't think you can do teeth and stuff like that.
Let's leave it there on that feeling of weirdness and uncomfortability, as we like to do on AFP. A reminder, we are on patreon.com/football podcast. You join us there, you get the shows ad-free, you get our bonus episodes, which we're going to record right now on the weekend that was in European soccer. So if you're interested in that, head on over to Patreon and join us there. We're on Twitter @afootballpod. Also, if you could give us a 5-star rating wherever you get this podcast, that would be great in terms of getting this pod into more people's ears. For producer Dylan, for his mastery on the ones and twos, and for Nick and David, thank you so much for listening to AFP. We'll talk to you next week.